I'm Marco Werman, and I want to take a moment to say thank you. Thank you to everyone who has stepped up to support this show in the last few weeks. And if you have not yet, don't worry, you can still right now. Just head to theworld.org/match and make a gift of any amount today. That's theworld.org/match. And thanks.
Heads up, fans of the world. While you've been listening to the show, we've entered a whole new era. We now live in a time when data is the new oil. That's right. It's like black gold. Dark, expensive, and whoever controls it has all the power. For the next few weeks, we'll be featuring a special podcast in your feed called Raw Data, all about life in this new data age. Raw Data from PRX, how your information gets turned into power. Check it out.
On a Wednesday in September of 1965, a small item showed up on the front page of the New York Times. CIA says Soviet seeks to discredit it. Not a super grabby headline, but the basic gist was this. The KGB had apparently set up a Department of Disinformation, and it was big into forged documents. The ultimate goal of all this fake information was to, quote, isolate and destroy Glavny Vrag, main enemy, the United States. It's the first time the word disinformation appeared in the New York Times.
Fast forward a few decades when this sort of thing started to happen.
Islamic Dawah Center. There's protests going on both sides of the street.
Anti-Muslim rally in Houston is making headlines today. That's because it was reportedly organized by Russian hackers pretending to be Texans.
Meddling in the U.S.
Misdirection, manipulation, disinformation. The same basic stuff that the KGB was up to back in 1965, but thanks to tech and social media, today disinformation can go viral.
And there's no special training required, just an internet connection, a decent command of English, and a rather nasty brand of creativity. Because, as the saying goes, on the internet, nobody knows you're a dog. Or, you know, an arm of a hostile foreign government. In other words, social media makes modern-day forgeries so darn easy. Russia's disinformation weapons of the Cold War era have gotten faster, cheaper, orders of magnitude more powerful.
This episode is the first of three we're doing about Russia manipulation and disinformation and the attempts to mess with our political process.
We're going to get into the technology and data later in the next two episodes. But to put it all into context, we need to start with some history, political history. Because what is happening now has its roots in Soviet Russia and the rise of Vladimir Putin.
This is Raw Data, a podcast about how information becomes power. I'm Mike Osborne.
And I'm Andrea Mustaine. I recently sat down with someone who has had a front row seat to Russian politics for many years, both before and after the fall of the Soviet Union. First off, can I just have you introduce yourself? Who are you?
I'm Michael McFaul. I teach at Stanford University.
And you don't just teach at Stanford University.
Well, I do lots of things.
Yes, Michael McFaul does indeed do lots of things. He's a professor of political science. He's director of Stanford's Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies.
Full disclosure, FSI is one of our underwriters.
He's a best-selling author. His latest book, From Cold War to Hot Peace, just came out in paperback.
And he served in the Obama administration. He spent 3 years at the National Security Council, working in the White House as special assistant to the president on Russian affairs, and then he was the U.S. ambassador to Russia from 2012 to 2014.
In other words, McFaul is an all-around Russia expert. He's been going there and lived there, off and on, since he was a college student in the early 1980s. But he can't go there anymore. He has been banned from the country.
And we will hear more about that in a little bit.
To understand the present, I wanted to start off by talking about the past and the Soviet Union a formidable nuclear superpower that posed an existential threat to the United States.
This is a show about how information becomes power.
Mm-hmm.
How did information relate to power in the Soviet Union? How did controlling information give them power?
In the Soviet Union, information was power because it was monopolized. There was no independent media in the communist system. All television channels were controlled. All print was controlled. You know, you would get on the train in the Soviet days and you turn on the radio and there was only one channel. And, it was broadcasting propaganda to you. You didn't have alternative views. And that did shape the way people saw the world. There's just no doubt about it. You know, the United States tried to fight that with Radio Free Europe.
Volá hlas svobodného Československa, Radio Svobodná Evropa.
Radio Svoboda, as they call it in Russian.
On May 1st, 1951, we broadcast for the first time on medium wave.
They had a magazine, I remember, called America that was printed in Russian that they tried to distribute out of the embassy pretty unsuccessfully. But I do remember one day getting a copy of that and giving it to some Russians, and they had never seen anything like that. And it was just photos of supermarkets, by the way. It was just Safeway. They'd never seen that. But that's a real great anecdote about how important it was for them to control what their citizens saw about us, because usually what they saw about us was homelessness, poverty, violence. And by the way, you know, lots of that was true. They just didn't show the complete picture of what American society was.
McFaul first visited the Soviet Union in 1983. Ronald Reagan was president. Leonid Brezhnev had just died. And Yuri Andropov, this brutal former head of the KGB, was in charge of the Soviet Union. And there was no end to the Cold War in sight.
When you were there the first few times and you're kind of just getting to know this new country, this new people, this new language, did you run into disinformation or propaganda among people? I mean, beyond the giant posters
Yes.
of Marx and Lenin, did you experience it in your everyday life, how it had influenced people's minds in any way?
In a couple of ways. I mean, in our classrooms, you know, all of our instructors, of course, were now I know this, I didn't know it at the time, but had to be cleared. And, you know, you had to be a special kind of person to interact with Americans during, you know, 1983. I'm sure there was lots of, you know, reporting to the KGB, and I'm sure there were KGB agents amongst our teachers. Whenever we kind of tiptoed into politics, yes, I mean, you know, I would hear what I would describe as propaganda from those people. What was more interesting is some of these more dissident people that I met. I met a guy, let's just call him Igor. It's no longer good to be associated with me, so I want to protect people. You know, he was interested in jazz, and, you know, he was very open to interacting with us, even though, you know, he had to assess the dangers of that. And even he, I would say, had really, views about the United States that were ill-informed because his information environment was highly constrained.
One thing that I thought was interesting in your book is that starting even when you were very young up until much more recently, it seems that everyone you encounter just assumed that you were some sort of United States government agent, which seems weird, especially when you were like a teenager. But does that somehow reflect the way life was there for people there, that there's this kind of general sense of secrecy and control
Yes.
and that people are not what they seem?
Yeah, I think that's right. So they're mirror imaging. That's right. Number one. Two, back then, the great deal of distrust. You know, this was a time when people would reveal things about their neighbors and their neighbors would go to jail. I mean, that's how that system works. So it was a very atomized society back then, and nobody trusted anybody. I remember once or twice trying to have certain Russians that I'd met through one set of contacts meet another set of Russians, and that was a big no-no, just because they didn't trust who those people were, and they didn't want it to be known that they were interacting with Americans.
So there was this legacy of distrust for good reason, it sounds like, because
Yeah.
neighbors did turn their neighbors in. Yep. Families turned in members in their own family. And
right.
literally tens of millions of people died under Stalin.
That's right. So that legacy was definitely alive and well when I was there. And just paranoia about interacting with foreigners as a result of that. You know, I remember climbing into a closet one night at some apartment because somebody got word that the police, the KGB, were coming through, and it would have been horrible for our host to be exposed with a couple of Americans in their apartment.
And this is not that long ago.
Yeah, not that long ago.
So just to review some of this history, and again, we're going to get into the data and tech in the next two episodes. In the early 1980s, as it had been for decades in the Soviet Union, there was no independent media. Information was entirely controlled by the government in a way that's almost even hard to imagine today.
The internet didn't exist. Travel was restricted. Contact with foreigners wasn't allowed. Anything that suggested you weren't towing the party line, basically, if you said anything that strayed from the government's version of reality, you could get arrested.
But then, in 1985...
For the third time in just 28 months, the body of a Kremlin leader lies in state in Moscow's ornate House of Unions.
Mikhail Gorbachev became the head of the Communist Party.
Mikhail Gorbachev is named the successor.
And he started to shake things up.
At 54 years of age, Gorbachev is the youngest man in the Politburo and has a style to match.
He introduced economic reforms called perestroika, or restructuring.
Change is coming to Moscow and coming soon.
And when perestroika ran into trouble, he decided to go big, and he introduced major political reform.
He decided to have the first semi-free and fair elections in 1989, and then the following year they had elections for the republic level, right? So like the state-level congresses. And in parallel to that, he did open up information. It's called glasnost, openness, and he allowed first newspapers to start publishing more critical things of the old system. It was an explosion of opening. You know, every new thing that became available was shocking, right? Seeing MTV for the first time. You know, that was like, oh my goodness, there's this whole other life.
Just getting warmed up.
I lived there many times. I lived there in 85, 88, 89, and then 90, 91. 91, the year the Soviet Union collapsed. And that's when information just started flowing, you know, in a way it hadn't probably forever in that country.
Moscow had not witnessed scenes like this since the...
And it seemed like, you know, the Cold War, this decades-long epic struggle for supremacy between the United States and the Soviet Union, that that was over. Was that the sense there that this was a new era and we weren't going to be enemies anymore?
Yes, that definitely was the sense. I would go to these demonstrations, hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. You know, they would happen fairly frequently. And August 1991, the old guard tried to put a kibosh on it.
Basically, the hardline communists hated all the reforms that were happening. And in August of 1991, they tried to take back control of the government.
They put Gorbachev under house arrest. And in Moscow, they sent in the army, tanks, literally the big guns. But the people of the city resisted. And there was this vivid moment when Boris Yeltsin, surrounded by crowds of people, climbed up onto a tank and gave this speech saying, "This takeover cannot stand."
Their coup failed after 3 days, and that's when basically the Soviet Union collapsed. And back then, the people that defeated the coup, these are people who are friends of mine, some of them still are my friends to this day, they thought that they were joining the West. They were the ones that won the Cold War. We were marginal players watching all this. They were the ones that ended the Soviet Union. They ended communism. And they thought that they were going to now join with us and you know, be part of the West and be part of a democratic society, a market-oriented society. Russia was going to rejoin Europe. That was a phrase you had heard quite a few times back then.
It just sounds so hopeful.
It was fantastic.
Gorbachev, the last president of the Soviet Union, resigns.
So the Soviet Union was over.
The red flag of communism is lowered over the Kremlin.
Decades of communist rule finished.
Yeltsin takes control of 30,000 Soviet nuclear...
And Boris Yeltsin was put in charge of leading a totally new system of government. And what is really kind of a new country. There's a new flag, a new name. Yeltsin even threw out the old national anthem. This epic work from the Stalin era. And replaced it with a piece by the 19th century Russian composer Glinka.
1991 seemed like the beginning of a new era. But...
between then and 1999, you have a really difficult period in Russia. The collapse of communism, the collapse of the command economy, the collapse of the Soviet Union. Remember, it's the largest country in the world. It now breaks up into 15 different pieces, had tremendous negative economic effects. And it would have had that no matter who is the leader, right? I think that's a big myth that somehow Yeltsin was responsible for it. That would have happened with anybody in power. And by the way, it happened in every communist country. It happened in Poland. It happened in Estonia. All of them had to go through this economic depression in order to reorganize the economy based on market institutions instead of communist institutions. But the coincidence of the introduction of democracy and economic depression made people skeptical about democracy, right? Very rationally so.
After 8 years of pretty terrible hardship, by 1999, things had finally started to turn a corner.
McFall says that 99 was the first year of economic growth. But then, on New Year's Eve, Yeltsin does something really weird.
That's when Yeltsin steps down and names his then Prime Minister Putin to take over for him as acting president. And that was a surprise. He was a completely unknown person.
But not completely unknown. It turns out that Michael McFaul had actually met Putin 8 years earlier, back in 1991, when Putin, this former KGB guy, was working for the mayor of St. Petersburg.
Do you remember meeting him? Did he make any impression on you at all?
Not really. I mean, I remember meeting him, and I remember he was in charge of international contacts with St. Petersburg. His boss was this very charismatic guy, Anatoly Sobchak. Putin was the opposite of that.
Would anyone have suspected in 2000, when Putin is all of a sudden elevated to lead Russia, that he would become the kind of leader that he is today?
Well, I was pretty nervous about him. In fact, I wrote a piece called Indifferent to Democracy in March of 2000 in the Washington Post, saying, you know, this guy doesn't seem that committed to the democratic project and we should be paying attention in the West. I was saying we were indifferent as well. And, you know, I think pretty early on in that first year, he made that known. And by the way, the very first thing he did was he went after information. He went after the two national television stations that were not controlled by the state. And it's a complicated story, but basically took them both over, understanding that controlling television is the way you're going to control society and the way you're going to build, you know, what later becomes a pretty autocratic regime.
So there were signs.
But not everybody. It was a debate. It's important to say that.
The debate ran like this. Putin had worked for this guy that McFaul mentioned earlier, a politician named Anatoly Sobchak, the mayor of St. Petersburg. And he was kind of a democratic reform hero. So, you know, maybe Putin was that kind of guy too.
But then again, Putin was this old school KGB guy who came up to the ranks of, you know, the secret police. He also brought back the old Soviet national anthem. With new words, but still.
But then, on the other hand, he seemed to be making some pro-Western moves.
There was a time when it seemed like he was open to Russia being more connected with the West.
Yes.
He had even floated the idea, I believe, of Russia maybe joining NATO at
Correct.
Some point.
Yeah, right in 2000 he said that, yeah.
So what happened?
Well, a couple of things. So I think always on the democracy piece, he was always suspicious of democracy. But that didn't mean that he was anti-Western or anti-market. And in those early years, he actually introduced some pretty radical market reforms. He reduced the income tax to a flat tax of 13%. That's way lower than we have in capitalist America, by the way. Over time, he's become more suspicious of private property and capitalism, believing that they don't serve the state. But that wasn't true when he first took over. And then with the West, I do think it's also, I'm glad you brought up his statement about NATO, because I think it is a more complicated story. I think initially he kind of had an open mind about it. September 11th then happens, and there is a real honeymoon right after September 11th in U.S.-Russian relations. He reaches out to George W. Bush and says, we have a common enemy here in terrorism. And, you know, that lasted for a couple of years. And then we started doing things that in Putin's eyes were against that partnership.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
We invaded Iraq. In his view, we supported color revolutions in Georgia in 2003 and in Ukraine in 2004. And I think those two events in particular, that's when he began to become even more suspicious about, you know, American behavior in the international system. And so by the time I got into the government in 2009, I think his views were pretty clear on us that we're out to dominate the world, to weaken Russia, and to suppress Russian sovereignty. And we're willing to use covert and overt force to overthrow regimes we don't like. And by the way, he's right about that. You know, we've done that from time to time. And the first time we sat down with him with President Obama, I was working at the White House at the time, was July 2009 in Moscow out at his dacha. You know, that's when he kind of laid out this theory about, well, you guys, this is what you do. And President Obama tried to explain that he was going to be different. When we got to Iraq, for instance, Putin said, you know, you guys made a complete mess of the Middle East with that. And Obama said, you're right. I agree with you. I was against that war. Yeah. And he kind of pulled back and looked at him like, hey, hold on. I'm playing the Russians here. You're supposed to be the Americans, because he'd never heard an American say that. Right. You know, we left that meeting thinking, well, maybe we can work with this guy because we wanted to be different. But then, you know, 2 years later, the Arab Spring happens and he blames us for that. And at the end of that year, demonstrations happen against him in his own country. And he blames us and me personally for those events.
What is it that he is so upset about? Because he's obviously open to market reforms, and it's not this kind of ideological fealty to communism. It seems like he's mad at the United States for pushing other people around. Is that accurate? And
yeah.
And why does he care so much?
Well, I think there are two pieces that are interrelated. One, he thinks that we dominate the world and that's unfair. He wants a multipolar world, not one dominated by the United States. Number two, he thinks we use multilateral institutions for our own advantage, and that's at a disadvantage to Russia. So European Union, even though we're not a member of the European Union, NATO, IMF, he would look to those to say those are American-dominated things. That's not good for Russia. But then this third thing is related, which is he thinks that we undermine the sovereignty of regimes like himself, and that we are out to overthrow autocratic regimes.
Well, and he's certainly correct. I mean, there's a lot to that, right? I mean, the United States has a very long history of intervening in ways both covert and overt.
Yep.
We could lay out the list here.
Yeah.
So on the one hand, sure, he's right. But on the other hand, why does it bother him so much?
Because he thinks we're out to get him. It's that simple. And when I was ambassador, It was really that simple. Right before I got there, but in December 2011, there was a parliamentary vote. It was falsified, like kind of normal rates for Russia, 5 or 6%. But this time, because of information, because it was not controlled, the people recorded this falsification on their smartphones and then spun it around on Twitter and VKontakte and Facebook, and it mobilized protests against him. And it got up to 200,000 people, just like it was back in 1991, 20 years ago, when there was regime change as a result of those massive crowds. So not without reason, he became paranoid about his own ability to rule Russia. But then he went a step further, again, I think, to mobilize his base and to marginalize the opposition, to blame America, Obama, and me for that. And that he would then portray, and here we are talking about disinformation. Again, I want to get, because we're on the line, right, of things we do, and then when they cross over. But it's a fuzzy line, just like we were talking earlier, where, was I sent to Russia to orchestrate the opposition against Putin to overthrow the regime? The answer to that is categorically no. That's just disinformation, but that was what was on Russian television while I was there. Do we support democratic, free and fair elections and human rights? The answer to that is yes. Did Secretary Clinton put out a statement criticizing the irregularities in that parliamentary election? The answer to that is yes. I know. I was the one that cleared it on behalf of the White House. And it's that statement in Putin's eyes where we're meddling in their internal affairs, where we're undermining his legitimacy. And in that area, he's partially right.
Partially right, because once it became clear that Putin had abandoned democracy in Russia, he wasn't exactly getting a lot of support from the U.S.
McFaul says that Putin has, kind of from day one, been really good at using the media to consolidate his power at home. But once he had that under control, he used it to go after his supposed enemies outside of Russia.
Even before 2011, he'd already started to invest in, broadcast media. He had already set up Russia Today, for instance, and understanding that he's not just going to play defense. He's going to go on the offense. And for him, he is fighting an ideological battle. It's not communism versus capitalism. But in his view, again, his view, not my view, he represents kind of traditional values, conservative values, orthodox values. And the United States represents decadent liberalism. We represent multilateralism. He represents the priority of sovereignty. And he's honed this worldview. And then I think he went on the offense. And so that was earlier. I think, the Arab Spring and then what happened in 2011, 2012 in his own country was when they began to look more closely at social media. And, it's just right after that that they begin investing in their own efforts at disinformation and then use that against us in 2016.
2 years ago, the acting attorney general asked me to serve as special counsel.
The Mueller report talks a lot about one entity in particular.
A private Russian entity engaged in a social media operation where Russian citizens posed as Americans in order to influence an election.
The benignly named Internet Research Agency, or IRA.
What is the Internet Research Agency? Let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, that's one of his friend, Prigozhin. They call him the Putin chef. He's the one that set that up. And it's a propaganda place on social media. It's not just propaganda, though. I want to keep emphasizing this, that not everything that happens on Russia Today or Sputnik or even IRA is propaganda. It's a mix. It's a mix. And a lot of it is then amplification of other things. And sometimes it's oftentimes it's amplification of things that are debates within societies that they're seeking to influence, right? So they didn't create polarization in America. They didn't create racism in America. We did that very well on ourselves, but then they amplified it, right? And I think that's a very important thing to understand about their strategy. that it's all of these things. Sometimes it's facts, sometimes it's disinformation, sometimes it's amplification. And IRA is one of the many instruments that he uses to do that.
So, Andrea, I have a question for you.
Sure.
These Russia disinformation techniques have been around a long time, but what does McFaul say that the connection is between what they were doing in the Soviet days and what they're doing today?
Well, in a somewhat roundabout way, I asked him about that.
I wonder when the outright fabrications that we now know about first came about and why. I'm talking about things that seem kind of crazy now, but this whole story about how the CIA had killed JFK.
Right.
There was something that the Soviets propagated about murdering the Pope, a plot against the Pope.
Right.
There was the whole thing about AIDS being produced in U.S. labs
right.
to kill African Americans. And those are just a few. I'm sure there are more.
Right.
But what in the world were they trying to do? Why make up these outlandish, crazy stories?
Well, I would say two things. Sometimes propaganda, disinformation, communist propagation, right, was designed to win hearts and minds over ideological things. And by the way, back then, they had a lot of material to work with. I mean, let's be honest, ideas of equality and, you know, the concepts of communism were attractive. And at one point, you know, hundreds of millions of people in the world were animated and admired those ideas. So there was that part where they were trying to win an argument. The second part, though, and the examples you just provided, I think, are illustrative of this, was also to diminish the United States, right? So that's not exactly the same thing. That's not trying to say we're superior to your system. It's like to add descriptions to your system that make you evil. And that most certainly was part of communist propaganda. Then there's a third element, which is definitely part of Putin's strategy today, which is to say that there is no truth at all. So it's not to win the argument. It's just to say everything's evil, everything's bad. Whataboutism is a part of that. So that people are just don't know what is up and what is down. 2 + 2 = 4 does equal 5. In that world, then there's not some moral superiority to liberal democracies versus, you know, corrupt autocracies. I think there was an element of that in the Soviet era, but I think it's become more prevalent today. I mean, we're even seeing how it's hard to constrain presidents that don't speak truthfully, even in our own open democratic society. But in that society, where the main channels are controlled by him, they're not constrained by truth. And that used to drive us nuts when I was ambassador, for instance. Like, we felt like we had to be constrained by truth. And just before I get to Helsinki, I just, you know, on this disinformation thing, I experienced it personally, right? They put out stuff about me that was untrue. The biggest theme was about that I'm here to foment revolution and these images of that. But they did some nasty things, too. They suggested I was a pedophile, for instance, right? And that was this constant disinformation with no, they didn't care about the truth. And they would Photoshop my head onto a poster. And once you're in that world, then you get to, you know, I sometimes think that Putin begins to believe his own crazy stories.
And Michael McFaul is actually at the center of one of those crazy stories. A few years ago, Russia put McFaul on a list that basically bars him from entering the country. In 2018, Putin offered a supposed reason why. At the Helsinki summit with President Trump, Putin offered the U.S. access to some accused Russian agents, but only if Russia got to interrogate Michael McFaul and a few other people.
Turned out that Putin was accusing McFaul of stealing tens of millions of dollars from Russia and giving it to Hillary Clinton.
Just the sort of conspiracy theory that often gets a lot of help from social media.
Do you have any reason to think that Putin will stop these efforts? Are these efforts continuing?
Yeah, they continue all over the world. And they'll only stop in the disinformation part when there are consequences to them. And so far, I would say that it's rational for Putin to calculate that the consequences have been rather minimal. And so I see us being in this ideological battle with them for decades, as long as Putin is around, and I think he'll be around for a long time. And in the disinformation piece, where they have an advantage because they're not constrained by the truth, I think that's going to go for a long, long time.
Do you think that American democracy is in danger?
We're threatened, but we're not in danger. Our institutions are robust, but we just have to fight for them. And, you know, I'm part of that fight.
So, you know, I guess I'm kind of surprised he's not more worried about the threat of disinformation and what it means to our political system.
Yeah, McFaul is someone who, you know, sees the reality, but he holds out a lot of hope, not only for our country, but for Russia. And, you know, for the power of truth.
There are lots of people in Russia fighting for truth. I know many of them. And in the long run, I bet on those fighting for truth. I think history's shown that eventually it's on their side. Right now, it doesn't seem that way. But, you know, I think in the long run, most people want to live in a truthful society. And autocrats have come and they've suppressed it for a while, including in the Soviet Union, including Russia today. But in the long run, I'm betting on truth, not Putin.
That was Michael McFaul, Russia expert, former ambassador, and a man now barred from the country he has spent his life studying. His most recent book, From Cold War to Hot Peace, just came out in paperback.
In the next two episodes, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of Russia disinformation efforts in the 2016 election and beyond.
So in our data, we're like, what is going on here? And that turns out there's this intersection of these conspiracy theories, this disinformation, and this rise of global populism. And we could see it in our data starting around 2015.
You've been listening to Raw Data from PRX. This episode was reported and written by Andrea Mustaine, and the podcast is produced by both of us.
Catherine Fenollosa is the episode producer. Curtis Fox is our editor. Ian Koss is our sound designer. Our theme is by Michael Linder at Hat Pineapple Productions.
Additional support from John Barth, Genevieve Sponsler, and Ray Pang.
Raw Data is supported by the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University, whose mission is to produce interdisciplinary research on critical global issues. Learn more about their research and upcoming events at fsi.stanford.edu.
Funding for Raw Data is provided by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. I'm Mike Osborne.
And I'm Andrea Mustaine. Thanks for listening.
If you liked this episode, check out the whole season of Raw Data, available wherever you get your podcasts.